From GPB News, this is On Second Thought. I'm Celeste Headlee. School is out for summer, but school scandals are in season. We'll talk about investigations into misuse of money and questionable ethics at two educational institutions. That's coming up. First, though, the Orlando nightclub massacre is still on our hearts and minds this morning, and yours too. Yesterday, we asked whether gun violence should be studied as a public health crisis by the CDC. Here are your first thoughts.
Hi, this is Mars from Atlanta. I'm calling about the Orlando shooting. I feel like violence needs to be prevented, but then also if people don't work to prevent violence against certain communities like queer people, they shouldn't be surprised when queer people begin to fight back.
Hi, this is Anne from Dunwoody. I don't see gun violence as any different than tobacco use. If the government sees tobacco use as a public health issue and is willing to go after big tobacco companies, why will the government not go after gun manufacturers and the NRA, considering that guns kill many, many people?
Hi, my name is Zach Jones, and I'm from Atlanta, Georgia. I just want to offer my sincere and heartfelt condolences to all of those affected. It is a tragic reminder that violence tends to be the economy of our country and of our world. I think that that ties into why it's important that we as a country, or at least our public sector, specifically the CDC, is allowed or given the right to study the global health or the public health implications of gun violence. We have got to understand why this seems to be a particularly American phenomenon among the Western developed world.
We always love to hear your thoughts. You can call us and leave a message like they did at 404-500-9457. We're also on the Twitter at OST Talk, or you can post to Facebook. And remember, we might feature your comments on the show. More than $600,000 spent on strip clubs, cars, and luxury retail. That was all stolen from the Atlanta Latin Academy Charter School last fall. The school's founder has been charged with theft and fraud, and the school closed its doors for good last month. A group of furious parents assembled to make their voices heard before the decision to shutter the academy was made final by the school board.
Shame on you. Look in the mirror at yourself at night. I hope you sleep well tonight. Know what you've done to these children. Shame on you.
Molly Bloom is a reporter for the Atlanta Journal-Constitution who's covered this scandal. Hello again, Molly.
Hello.
How did they discover the money was missing?
The money was discovered missing after the school hired a new principal, and the new principal got copies of the bank statements and sat there looking at the bank statements and noticed there were some really unusual charges.
And like $12,000 for a strip club.
Exactly. Strip clubs, cash withdrawals, some things that didn't appear to be usual for a school.
When you say cash withdrawals, taking out hundreds of dollars from an ATM.
Exactly, yeah.
And I want to make sure, because $12,000 at a strip club, please tell me that was over a course of visits. That wasn't just one $12,000 visit.
That particular charge was a single visit. I'm told it's possible to do that in a single night at some Atlanta strip clubs.
Okay. And there was also charges from a Mercedes-Benz dealership?
There was a charge to a Mercedes dealership, charges at restaurants, at Hooters, places that you wouldn't expect to be part of school field trips.
And because the founder has been charged, that implies that they have found connections between the school's founder and these charges, that he has been connected at least to the charges at the Mercedes-Benz dealership and perhaps the strip club as well?
I couldn't say about specific charges, but he has been charged in connection with the theft. Police do say it's an active investigation. They're still looking at the charges, so it may be possible there could be additional arrests.
Now, the parents, granted, they're very emotional, but they want to see other people charged as well. Has anyone else been implicated in terms of knowing that this was going on and not doing anything?
So the only one who's been arrested is the founder, Chris Clemens. The parents I've talked to say that they're still looking for answers. They're still trying to understand how this happened, who was responsible.
Right. And they're blaming, to a certain extent, the school board. Now, the school was closed. Why?
The school was closed. There's a nine-member governing board. And the board chairman says the school was just in this deep financial pit. It could not have found a way to survive in the coming year. The Atlanta School District, which oversees the Latin Academy Charter School, had said, we plan to terminate your charter, which would have effectively closed the school. So the school's own governing board acted first and voted to close the school.
The money that was stolen, which was somewhere in the neighborhood of $600,000, was that public funds? Who was paying for the charter school?
Mm-hmm. Those were public tax dollars that came, you know, came to the school through state funding.
And as far as we know, just gone. That money cannot be recouped unless somebody is charged, convicted, and has to pay a fine back.
Well, the school does have an insurance company. There is this, you know, criminal prosecution, and so I guess it's possible there could be restitution. But the board said, there's no way, you know, we don't have this money now. We can't stay open for the coming year. We just don't have the funds.
Right. So what happens to the kids that go to the charter school?
That's a really good question. I mean, there were about 200. It's a middle school. So just looking at the 6th and 7th grades, there were about 200 kids. And the middle schools in that area, the traditional public schools, don't do that well academically.
Yeah.
And so you have parents who are just scrambling, saying it's really hard to find a seat at a high-performing charter school this late in the year. You know, private school is
expensive. And this charter school was founded to try and fix this very problem that you're talking about, was it not?
Yeah, exactly. And it was a relatively high-performing school academically. It was in the top quarter of middle schools in Atlanta, and parents say their kids felt safe there. They felt like their kids were learning, and now it's not there. So they're just scrambling to find another option.
Okay, so here we come back again. This is another school scandal. Is it just our impression that there are a lot of school scandals in Atlanta?
Or is it just the AJC? This is obviously a very different type of situation than the Atlanta Public Schools cheating scandal. It's
clearly, yes.
Very different.
You understand that it gives people a feeling like we can't trust what's going on behind closed doors at our public schools and charter schools. Is that founded, or is the amount of shenanigans going on in context? There's always going to be a certain amount of shenanigans, even if you were in Washington State or in Minneapolis or wherever you might go, or are we seeing a higher amount here?
I mean, in Atlanta and Georgia nationally, there are people who steal from public entities, including public
yes.
schools. I mean, that happens even when you have safeguards, people do bad things.
Right.
But there are best practices you can put in place to try to prevent them, right?
Uh-huh.
And it seems like that didn't necessarily happen at this charter school.
When you're talking about best practices that it didn't necessarily happen, are you saying that those best practices have not been implemented here, or that they were not carried out?
I think it's a combination. You have charter schools have some flexibility in comparison to traditional public schools, so they have, you know, smaller administrations, so there are often fewer people looking at the books. Mm-hmm. There are also policy, you know, you can have policies like not allowing people to make cash withdrawals with a debit card.
Seems odd.
Yeah. Having multiple people, required to sign a check, having separating duties in terms of receiving invoices and then paying them out. So there's oversight and policies you can put in place that can help prevent this kind of thing.
And those are the kind of policies which already exist in a standard public school, but not in a charter school, correct?
Well, it depends on the charter school. I mean, there are tons of charter schools. Obviously, this is one, but this doesn't happen at every charter school because, you know, some charter schools do put these practices in place. And, you know, obviously the people vary from charter school to charter school.
But it is the largest charter school theft in Georgia history. Yeah.
It is. And there were also two Fulton County charter schools that had just started up when these thefts were discovered that were also associated with Chris Clemens.
Oh, boy. So people are looking at those books as well, I assume?
Those schools say that, more than $100,000, possibly more, was taken from those schools, too.
Which is inching us close to $1 million.
Exactly.
So what are the questions that are now being asked about how to prevent this and to make sure that oversight is sufficient, whether it be a public school or a charter school?
Well, the the state legislature passed a law that requires more training for charter schools, more financial training, and also separates the duties in terms of finances so that someone like Chris Clemens, who was leading the school, wouldn't also be over finances. So that would remove one possible way for money to be stolen.
Okay. Although training, I don't think, would prevent someone from spending $12,000 at a strip club.
You'd be surprised. I don't know.
Okay. So tell me what the fallout may be from this. I mean, it sounds like this is just the beginning of what we may find and hear reported about this particular theft. Is that accurate? This is going to be in the headlines for a while because it sounds like we're also going to find out what happened at these other two schools. They could investigate further to see if there's anybody else implicated. What are the questions you still have?
I mean, I think we're still trying to get to the bottom of how exactly this happened. I mean, there's a forensic audit that the school board paid for. We haven't been able to get a copy of that.
But it's completed?
It's completed. We filed a Georgia Open Records Act request for it. The school denied it. So there's just getting to the bottom of how exactly this happened. There's a whole criminal case that's going to unfold. You know, the investigation is ongoing. So there's that piece. And there's also what's going to happen to these kids. I mean, you know, school's going to start in a couple months, and where are they going to be? How are they going to do? You know, what are their futures?
And what is he charged with?
He's charged with theft and fraud.
Which are felonies?
Yep, they are felonies.
Okay, so that we're talking he could spend years in prison.
Potentially.
If he is convicted.
Yeah, and right now he's in jail in Colorado, so there's a whole extradition. He's from Colorado, so there's a whole extradition process that has to go through. And so it could take a while before we get the full story.
Okay, I didn't realize he was in Colorado. So, I mean, we have a couple minutes left. Where was he spending the money?
The charges that we saw were in Atlanta.
So he was flying from Colorado to Atlanta, taking money out of an ATM.
No. So the ATM charges were mostly in Atlanta. At some point after the new principal came on board, he left Atlanta.
He left and he moved to Colorado. Okay, exactly. That was a portion that I was not aware of. So he's sitting in the slammer in Colorado, and he has to be extradited from one state to another. And so that could, I mean, it just sounds, Molly, like this is the beginning of a tangle, and mm-hmm. it could be a while before this is all comes clean.
Yeah, exactly, before we all get the answers that we want.
But in the meantime, we know that he stole he's alleged to have stolen $600,000 from one school and possibly $100,000 to $200,000 or more from two other charter schools.
Yeah, he's accused of a, you know, pretty substantial crime.
Whew. Okay, my guest is AJC reporter Molly Bloom. We are talking about the $600,000 scandal that shut down the Atlanta Latin Academy Charter School. Certainly, if you have concerns about this or questions, you can tweet us your thoughts at OST Talk. And if there are questions that Molly can answer, maybe we can get an answer for you as well. Molly, thank you so much.
Thank you.
This is On Second Thought. A new exhibit at Atlanta's High Museum of Art celebrates footwear. Out of the box, the rise of sneaker culture is a collection of creative shoe designs from famous brands like Nike, Converse, and Adidas. It's a display that makes sneakerheads like Layla Turner drool as she walks through the exhibit.
Over here, I can't believe I ever would see these. This is definitely my favorite pair.
She points to a pair of sky blue Nike Supremes from 2003. They're accented by white leather with gold stars on the side panels. Rumor has it Nike released only 1,000 of these sneakers, and Layla says this shoe signaled a transition for the multi-billion dollar sneaker giant.
This transformed everything. This is where Nike went from being basketball and like running oriented to a completely different culture to skateboarding. And this became like a completely different subculture. And I mean, they still make.
What do you mean? Like that's when it sort of entered into fashion?
Yeah, I would say. I mean, well, it's always been a part of fashion, but I would say like a different type of fashion, like a alternative, and more like a punk era, I guess.
Right.
Too.
Like maybe these are ones you'd actually put on to for an outfit as opposed to put on to go play hoops.
Exactly. Because Converse emerged initially as like, you know, you don't have to play basketball, but you can still wear sneakers. Mm-hmm. And then Nike came out with these and said, we can do this too.
One of the things that happens with this and the section that it's in the show is really about when the shoe companies start to seek collaborations.
That last voice is exhibit curator Sarah Schleining.
And so exactly what Layla's sort of saying is that you see one of the really, I mean, so the Ramones made the Converses so cool, right? That's what
the
made
band,
all of a sudden you were like, you could be a punk rocker and you could wear your Converse and you didn't have to be athletic. But I think what is the huge pivotal moment is Run DMC with Adidas.
My Adidas was a hit song for the rap group Run DMC in 1986. It helped solidify a space for sneakers as part of the uniform for unconventional musicians.
It really identified that idea that you could collaborate outside of the sports business and create people. So why Jordan made Nike within the sports business so phenomenal and really brought in all the kind of grant hit. I mean, just that continues the kind of basketball and sport collaboration. What you also see is them seeking other, really in the end, other markets, other ways, other people who are interested in consuming sneakers and looking at different ways that they can be designed.
So forget the way I'm supposed to walk through it. Take me to your favorite pair of shoes.
Oh, my favorite pair of shoes? Ooh, that's hard. I think my favorite is, so I'm originally from Portland, Oregon, so I am deeply steeped in the lore of Nike, and my brothers are both runners, so I really love the Waffle Trainer, and that's over here. So this is the kind of lore of this is Bill Bowerman was trying to figure out how to make a better running shoe. So this is in the early 70s, so 72. And he's just teamed up with Phil Knight. Phil Knight was a grad student in Stanford, was trying to think about ways to sell sneakers. So the kind of legend is that he poured rubber on, he ruined his wife's waffle iron and made this incredible waffle sole. I love them. They're very much part of my childhood, to date myself. I mean, this whole idea of the running generation, which really emerged in the 70s, this idea about personal bests and pushing yourself against yourself. But this was when people really started jogging and running and doing all these kind of road races. And one of the great things about a lot of these running shoes is they were sort of unisex. So,
well, you got Farrah Fawcett in her pair.
Yes, in her Cortez. So
yes.
Those, and I think that was one of the things we really appealed to me about this exhibition was, I mean, the sneaker or whatever you call it, kicks, trainers, tennis shoes, however you term them, really are part of our daily life. And everybody has stories about which ones they wore, why they coveted certain ones, how they, whether you got them dirty or you kept them super clean, whether you drew on them and detailed them out yourself. I think that's so part about how what we wear becomes part of our identity. And what you choose to wear cultivates how you want to be perceived and how you kind of perceive yourself. And that to me was a really powerful part of taking the story of a single kind of shoe, the sneaker, and starting in the 1830s was sort of how it developed and evolved and bringing it into its kind of full ripening, which is kind of right now and in the 21st century.
You heard Sarah right. The first sneaker was designed in the 1830s. That's about 180 years ago. The out-of-the-box exhibit has some of the earliest of these designs on display.
You know, one of the really exciting things to me about this exhibition is it really does take you to this early moment. So one of the things you have to think about when you think about the early 1900s is you have kind of the rise of the Industrial Revolution, but you also have people moving out of rural environments into urban cities. And so that kind of culminates with the very exciting topic about vulcanizing rubber. What happens is, you know, rubber is really something that's extracted from weeping trees, as they call it, so it's sap or rubber. And initially, before they could vulcanize it, it was very unstable and it had troubles. And so we do have one pair of shoes that's quite fragile that is pre-vulcanized rubber. And you can see it's not the most aesthetically, it's not
they
like the
like
Stewie.
It's hooves.
Not, yeah, they're just black, very black, somber shoes. But what happens is once you put, vulcanization is about mixing it with heat and sulfur and really
makes it resistant to temperature changes.
Yes. And more malleable and easier, and then it basically becomes less expensive also. Easier to work with and less expensive to extract. And that's really what starts to push it being used into shoes. And so right next to the first pre-vulcanized shoe, we have really what was a very early running shoe, and it looks really like a dress shoe.
It does.
And it's meant to look like that. It's not really, I mean, this is, again, a form trying to find its identity. And so it's sticking with what it knows. And this is kind of what shoes were looking like. And what they start to do is explore, and you see this in this first section, mixing it with canvas. What is the upper going to be? Is it leather? Is it canvas? And part of what really pushes it is trying to find shoes for kids. Because, like I said, as you move people into the city, all of a sudden you need to think about where they're going to exercise.
And they're pounding the pavement,
yeah.
And it wears the leather soles out.
But exercise also becomes important because they're no longer working the farms.
Oh, right.
And they need things to do. So you have things like the rise of court sports like basketball, because all of a sudden you need a very small footprint for a certain amount of exercise. And you see those rise in cities. And so you have the development of basketball and tennis and other things that really get pushed by the development of these sneakers.
It's in this part of the exhibit that I notice a pair of shoes that stood out for me.
Tell me about these shoes, because those do not look like sneakers. Those are ladies' shoes, quite formal by today's standards, with a heel. What, a 1-inch, 1.5-inch heel?
Yeah, so the show is really mostly about male culture. But there are some women's shoes that are in it, and they talk about the development of women's shoes. So this is a kind of an early sneaker for women, but it is mimicking sort of that kind of Oxford shoe quality. It has that the kind of short lace-up and that same sort of detailing that you would see sort of on Oxford and a very pert, cute little heel.
Yeah, it looks a little bit like a baseball.
And it looks like something you'd wear to play baseball. But I mean, you have to think at this moment, I mean, people, the kind of idea of physical culture for women was not like today. I mean, you think about women's bathing costumes and this whole kind of idea. It was really different. And so this kind of, in a way, makes you think about how much also the female identity, especially in relationship to sports, has really changed. But I think, you know, the joke in the kind of when you start to delve into it is that women's sneakers, you shrink them and pink them. And that's basically right. You know, if you're trying to find a women's shoe, you either go and buy a men's shoe in your size, or they've made them, you know, smaller and pink and adorable. But it's not really necessarily what we want, speaking as a woman, and a curator now.
A woman wearing black sneakers.
Like these are Rihanna's Fenty trainers. She did for Puma. But I think, yeah, I mean, we want diversity and we want great design and we don't need to have small pink shoes to wear sneakers.
Not surprisingly, Layla Turner has on some pretty cool kicks herself.
I'm wearing some high top Dornbecker's. So basically what Nike does is there's a hospital in Oregon called Dornbecker and they get the children to basically make designs for shoes and they put them on there. And this was a child that was sick with cancer and she loved Alice in Wonderland. And this is her design that they put out. So all the proceeds went back to the hospital.
Are they comfortable?
They're comfortable. And like we were talking about earlier, I mean, they have a heel. So they're wedged.
Yeah.
I never thought I would see so many women wearing like dresses with LeBrons and Jordans. I mean, it's becoming more of like a female culture too. Like, I mean, women are getting more into sneakers than, you know, most people would think.
Sneaker culture has grown up, and it's found its footing alongside industrial music and fashion trends. But there are some unfortunate consequences that come with the cultural explosion.
So, and this is a question for both of you. You know, there's a little bit of ugliness as well to the sneaker culture. Obviously, there's been a huge amount of, well, huge, relative to the fact that they're sneakers, amount of violence associated with people getting beaten up, people sometimes getting assaulted, or in a few cases even killed for their sneakers. How do you celebrate the sneaker culture at the same time keeping in mind, in some cases, the violence that it has, I don't want to say encouraged, but in some ways, yeah, caused?
Well, I mean, I would say that with passion anywhere, there's going to come violence. I mean, the culture is passionate, and there's going to be violence. I mean, I know that it's definitely a negative connotation, and, like, another thing, too, is, like, people were trying to wear their sneakers in prison, and, like, when you see people without the laces, that usually represents, like, that they've been in prison. There's a lot of negative connotations, but there's also a lot of positive connotations, just like with anything, you know?
I just think, like anything we do, I mean, we're a public institution that is interested in exploring ideas. And part of the exploration of the ideas, I mean, this is an art museum, and we're looking at the design of these. And part of embedded in the design is the kind of culture. And so while the show doesn't directly address that, it is something we're aware of. And I think it's something we hope people will talk about when they look at them and when you think about them and when you place them in a kind of coveted way, which is how they're displayed here. I mean, they're under these plexi bonnets. We're celebrating them as incredible kind of icons of design and things that should be celebrated for how they look and how they're made. We know anytime you do that, it raises the level of and their meaning. And so it's something...
I mean, literally on a pedestal.
Literally fetishizing them on a pedestal. But I think we know the responsibility that that means, and part of what we want to do is also then encourage the dialogue about the kind of all the kind of ideas around it.
In a room of shoes-turned-collector's items, I had to wonder how much a sneaker fan like Layla spent on her personal collection.
I would say at least $3,000, if not more. But, like, working at Nike, I got a free pair every 6 months, too. So, I mean...
You just recruited a whole bunch of people for Nike.
Yeah. I mean, if you want to work for Nike, that's a great company. So, definitely. I have more than 200 pairs of shoes. So, it's a passion.
If I'm enmeshed into sneaker culture and I wear mostly Nikes, can I go buy an Adidas? And everyone is not going to say anything?
I mean, there's a lot of people that do, but, like, me personally and the people that I know that are also sneakerheads, they don't. I mean, like, recently with our Basquiat show, Reebok did a collaboration and came out with some Basquiat sneakers, and I tried my hardest not to buy them, so it's hard. But
Wait, but you did buy them?
No, I did not buy them, but I wanted to buy them. It's just, it's brand loyalty and, you know, definitely. I think there's a set of rules.
Have you stood in line for a sneaker?
Yes, I have.
Which one?
I stood in line for the LeBrons that came out on Christmas 2 years ago. So
how long did you wait?
5 hours.
Holy cow.
Yeah.
Worth it?
Yeah. It was worth it. But that's definitely a pair I keep in the box. Yeah. I will not wear it. That's dead stock for me. So yeah.
Dead stock.
Yes.
After the tour, we stood around and talked shoes a little more. I quickly found out everyone has a sneaker story, even if they're not a sneakerhead.
So this was for me. So I grew up in Portland.
Uh-huh.
And we always, when we got our new tennis shoes, we always made them filthy. Like, that was like, yeah. You never showed up at school with clean
exactly.
sneakers. That was embarrassing.
Yes.
And so we used to, like, take them out. In Portland, it's easy to do that, and make them filthy. And then when I went to college in New York, people were, like, horrified by my sneakers because they were all, like, they were white and pristine, and they were like, why do you do that to your, and they had the shoe polish and the whole thing, and I would remember, and then they, you know, I grew up with them being tennis shoes, and then all of a sudden it was sneakers, and, but I would remember just being completely, like, thrown that their
yeah, the
idea
different,
of, like, I was
the
like,
the only shoe you were allowed to keep clean was your Keds.
Yes.
Keds had to be clean. Every other shoe, including your Vans, had to be... And the
Correct.
Burnout guys always had their toe sticking through the top of the Vans.
The exhibit is called Out of the Box, The Rise of Sneaker Culture. It will be at Atlanta's High Museum through August 14th. For more information and photos from our tour, you can find them all at gpbnews.org. And we'd love to hear from you. Tell us about your favorite pair of sneakers. Was it one you grew up with, or maybe a limited edition like Layla's? Tweet us at OST Talk or join our conversation on Facebook. This is On Second Thought.
We heard earlier about a $600,000 scandal, maybe more, from a doomed charter school in Atlanta. Now let's talk about another school scandal in Georgia. Kennesaw State University President Daniel Papp suddenly announced his retirement last week after 10 years on the job. Investigators found Papp collected more than $500,000 in retirement benefits while he still served as university president. Auditors discovered a major conflict of interest as well with KSU's food services department, and that maybe cost the university more than $400,000. Reporter Janelle Davis has covered this story extensively for the Atlanta Journal-Constitution, and she joins us now. Hello again, Janelle.
Good morning. Thank you.
All right. I'm going to try to walk through this step by step, because even for me, this is a little confusing. Let's start just with Daniel Papp. Mm-hmm. He is the outgoing president. He retires officially as of June 30th, correct?
Correct.
Okay. He announced his retirement suddenly after he saw what was going to be in the report. Is that fair?
Well, he would say it's not. He announced his retirement very abruptly.
Yeah.
Last month in May, the Kennesaw State was having like 2 days of commencement services ceremonies. And so he announced his retirement on the first day, like that night. I think a letter went out to the campus community like 9 o'clock the night of the first set of commencement ceremonies, and we found out about it early the next morning. We were alerted to that, and so people were kind of wondering what was going on. I know we were, especially because that's not usually how these kinds of announcements work. And so he at that time said that it was just time for him to go, that he had served for 10 years. And I asked the question, well, are you being asked to step down? And he said, no, it was just time for him to go. And he felt like 10 years was a good time to make that change.
Okay, but we have this auditor's report, and it has a number of things that it points out as questionable or in some cases fraudulent. Let's start with the first one of deferred compensation. How much money are we talking about here, and why was he collecting retirement while still serving?
Yes, good question. With the deferred compensation piece, we're talking about, about $500,000, a little bit more than that, that he was collecting from the Kennesaw State Foundation. And that was a violation of policy, the fact that he was collecting it
While still being paid a salary.
Usually that kind of compensation is paid, first of all, at the discretion of the Board of Regents and of the Chancellor. And in this case, that didn't happen. The foundation, did not have that authority and that allowance. And also, like you said, usually that kind of compensation is paid when a president, leaves his job, either through
when
retirement,
they actually retire.
Yeah, or go to another job or something like that. And he was still being paid this money while serving as president.
Okay, so then there's the question of annual leave. Mm-hmm. He got almost $14,000 more in annual leave. Why did they point out that this was a policy violation?
This was, as you know, Dr. Papp served prior to his time at Kennesaw State. He served for a long time, 43 years even, within the university system in various positions at various institutions, including some time at the system office. So during the transition between those jobs, he collected some additional annual leave that carried over from year to year that he wasn't supposed to.
Because he was still working and collecting a salary.
Yes. So he, though, has since paid back that $14,000, almost $14,000. He's paid that portion back.
But not the $577,500 that he hasn't paid back that he received in retirement funds.
That remains to be seen what happens with that. According to the auditor's report, Dr. Papp has until 30 days from the report. The report was released June 2nd, so I guess July 2nd, to respond with his own, whatever his response is regarding those fees and those funds and the entire report. So we may have some more information coming at that time about what has happened with that.
Craig Fluck tweets to us, I think I found out why tuition is so high. That's a joke, obviously. So far, there's no connection so far to tuition costs at Kennesaw State. But one more thing that the auditors pointed to in relation to Daniel Papp, the outgoing president, And they say that the car allowance he received was a policy violation as well. Why?
That, again, was paid through the foundation, and that the university system, their policies only allow, I guess, about $10,000 for presidents for that car allowance. And Dr. Papp received...
What do you mean? They get $10,000 to pay for their car payments or gas? Or what is the car allowance?
Well, in this case, I believe that the money was going to... Because I think the administrators may lease vehicles, and so they change them out. And so the car, you know, the funding goes toward that. And usually it's not paid like maybe directly to them, but to the, you know, to pay the lease agreement or whatever the payment is. And so he was receiving more than he should each year.
He got twice as much as he was supposed. He got $20,000 instead of $10,000. And that was that for the whole 10 years that he was at Kennesaw?
That was for a portion of that that time.
Number of years.
Yeah, at least a number of years.
Okay, so I want to step away from Daniel Papp. As I said, he has announced his retirement. He retires as of June 30th. And those three things that I mentioned, retirement pay he collected, the annual leave he collected, and his car allowance are the things that financial auditors pointed to as violations. Okay, now the incoming interim president also fired four other high-ranking officials, and one of them resigned, and that's Randall Shelton. Why? What are the allegations or I guess indiscretions? What's going on with Randall Shelton?
Sure, that was the result of another two set of auditors' reports that also came out the same day as the report on Dr. Papp.
Multiple financial audits.
This one, though, was kind of involving the division that is responsible for food services and dining and that sort of thing. And so Mr. Shelton was the director of that division.
Right.
And was cited for a number of violations, conflict of interest.
He did consulting work for some of the ones he was hiring.
Correct.
But why did they say this may have cost the university $400,000 or more?
Yeah, that was one of the included in the auditor's report was a information from a complaint that they received that one of the vendors that Mr. Shelton allowed to come back on the university may have cost them that much because of the money they had to the university had to pay in franchise fees and kind of to redo the building, some construction work there, and losses as well.
Right. I want to make sure I understand because it was a place called Wow Wingery,
mm-hmm.
And they got a tip on their ethics hotline. Which I didn't know existed. And the university actually had to make a whole bunch of building improvements. And they also included some lost revenue in the amount of $430,000 that KSU lost in order to bring this back. And so Randall Shelton resigned.
Yes, he did.
And these four other officials were fired. Was that because, do we know why they were fired?
Their termination letters, do not tie directly to the audits. You know, they're sort of the typical form letter saying that because there's a change in administration that Dr. Davis is kind of bringing
in
his
own
people.
But come on.
And that's the thing. Several readers have, have questioned that as well. And when you look at kind of the chain of command.
Yeah,
they all worked very closely. Working together.
Mm-hmm. So, okay. At this point, we have how many financial audits went forward? Three?
Three. Mm-hmm.
Okay. And at this point, they have now been turned over, as I understand, to the Georgia Attorney General's office.
Right.
What does that mean? What happens now?
Well, there could be some investigation by the Attorney General's office. One of Mr. Shelton's direct reports that was also included in the audit. A previous attorney general's investigation turned that over to the GBI, for example.
The Georgia Bureau of Investigation.
Correct.
Yeah.
So they are still looking into another kind of aspect of this as well. So
yeah, that's a completely separate thing.
Mm-hmm.
Could there be criminal charges?
I'm not sure. I guess maybe depending on what officials find.
So what assurances have we heard from Kennesaw State? How are they handling all of this? Because this is a lot. It is a lot.
Definitely.
And I have to imagine they're getting a lot of questions from students. How are they responding?
Well, when you say a lot of questions, you're exactly right. And I know our readers have had a lot of questions as well. One of the big things that people have really questioned is the fact that how could all of this have happened? I mean, especially with the Dr. Papp portion. And in his response to this, he has said that, some of this was miscommunication between the foundation and university officials and himself. He wasn't aware that these were violations in some cases, but people have questioned, you know, how could a person with 43 years of experience in an agency not have known the rules? So I think that's where some of the disconnect has come, and people are kind of waiting to see what happens.
And the other question is, how could this have all happened without someone else knowing as well, which would lead one to question whether or not the investigation would broaden beyond Daniel Papp, Randall Shelton, and the four people that were fired.
Correct.
Okay, it's all interesting, and I'm sure many of our listeners have questions as well. You can send them to us. We will pass them over to Janelle and see if there's some answers. If you are a Kennesaw State student, alum, or faculty member, give us your thoughts. We're on Twitter at OST Talk. Janelle Davis is a reporter for the Atlanta Journal-Constitution. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Tim Sweetwood has been an important part of Atlanta's music scene for more than a decade. He started out as a music promoter. Now he's a major player as the founder of two annual Atlanta music festivals, Shaky Knees and Shaky Beats. Producer Trevor Young caught up with Sweetwood during the Shaky Knees Festival last month and asked him to nominate two songs for our Georgia playlist. That is our ever-growing essential list of songs written or performed by Georgians. Here are his picks.
I am Tim Sweetwood, promoter and founder of the Shaky Knees Festival. My first pick for the Georgia playlist is Take My Bones Away by Baroness off their Yellow and Grebe album from 2012. So with the song in particular, I'd say what kind of gets me off is I can see their influences in it, which so that goes back to being outside of a Georgia band, but what, again, makes them unique. So, you know, it's got elements of a Deep Purple in there. It's got the metal side where I can hear the lyrics. I've never been a Cookie Monster fan of lyrics. It's got a few of the breakdowns that you can think of where it hits hard, but then it goes back to that melodic sound. I'll find them every day. It seems like their lyrics in particular are not influenced by the outside world, but more influenced by them. And I think some of the writing styles of other bands these days, when it comes a little more in the pop, is they're writing for something to be popular, right? So Baroness is a really good example of a band that has just like the slow trickle growth. My second pick for the Georgia playlist is something a little more popular, would be Melissa by Allman Brothers. Crossroads, same will come and go. Yeah. I first started listening to that band when I was really young, probably late grade school, junior high, all of that element, and then they were definitely in my repertoire of going to shows when I was in high school for the first time. I have a bit of the origins and the jammier or more roots side of music, even though I've grown out of that. Sweet Melissa. Looks the same. I think when you're young in a song like this, when the ballad in Melissa is something that's, for me, it's something where it's obvious they're writing it about a person or a time in their life. And when you're young, you haven't experienced that. So it's something a little more like, oh, maybe that could be me. Love's deepest dreams, the gypsy fly, the sweet Melissa. When you're young, they're influential where, you know, nowadays it's, for me, the business is wrapped around so much of the music, and back then there was no business related to it, so it was more the chance of, was I underage and trying to get a beer and just be hot and sweaty in the Georgia sun to see the Allman Brothers? Yes. And there was a little bit more simplicity to it. It's loose, which again is a little more of Georgia and a little more of South. You know, it's like if you're in the city of Chicago, you think of blues, or you think of a little bit faster pace. If you're in New York, it's super faster pace. When you're in Georgia, it's slowed down. So I think that's how it relates a little bit more to like the ballad side of things, you know. Yes, I know that he won't stay
without my Melissa. That's Tim Sweetwood with his selections for our Georgia Playlist series. The entire series can be found at gpbnews.org under the Music tab. And that's our show for today, but I want to know if there's a song that you think should be included on the Georgia Playlist. Let us know. Call us at 404-500-9457. You can also tweet us at OST Talk. And just remember, you can't nominate your own song if you're a musician. For today, that is On Second Thought from GPB News. I'm Celeste Headley. Have a great day.